You're listening to Solveig Speisa Musik on Radio Rakel FM 99.3. My name is Solveig Sørbø, and I'm the host of this show. And I'm also having a co-host today. Her name is Agata Zielichowska. Thank you.
Hello.
And hello, hello. Our guest for this broadcast and this episode, which is also part of Night of New Vocalities, and is premiered as a night broadcast. And her name is Kristin Nordervall. And welcome.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here again.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, people can check out previous episodes with Kristin as well. Just look up Vox Lab, Extended Voice, Utvidet. I think I wrote plus room or plus sted, something like that. Yeah. Anyway. So now we're here today, but this is the first time that we're having a whole episode focusing on your work. And you're an American-Norwegian composer, vocalist, singer, improviser, educator, technologist, so many things, and a community maker as well, I'd say. I mean,
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for having me again and this focus. You're also a very big community maker.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so what was your what's your focus when you make music? I mean, I know it's vocal music, but that's a lot, right?
That's a big category. You know, I was thinking I have sung as long as I can remember. So it's something that I did, that it's joyous, it expresses whatever. I mean, just like children express wherever they are in emotionally or what they're experiencing or what they're trying to get across, express it vocally. But I was very, very drawn to music. I was very aware of pitches. I was very aware of listening to my mother play the piano, listening to things that were on the radio. And as I, like the very first song that I remember kind of cueing into as a child was Maria from West Side Story, which is kind of an interesting melody for a child to remember, but it really caught me. And then the song, the singers that made an enormous impact on me were singers from the American musical tradition of blues, folk, singer-songwriters that really had something to say. Odetta was really important to me. And Buffy St. Marie was really important to me. They were both touching on issues that were difficult issues and being able to sing things that you couldn't necessarily say. And I just listened recently to a video or watched a video that where the New York Times was doing a profile on Odetta because she just died a few years ago. I'm not sure exactly how many years. I'd have to look that up. But she really talked about that connection to singing where you know, that you could express things that you were angry about. And the way she put it was, here we are, you know, we were living with a foot on your neck all the time. But so you could sing, put that into the music so that you could survive it and heal it in some way, you know, just make it through. So those kind of singers made a real impact on me. I lived in Canada for a while as in high school. And, of course, Joni Mitchell was a national treasure, and she's a genius. And her type of personal storytelling in her words and her type of melodies and the harmonies that she was using, that really changed the music industry. I mean, she was a pathbreaker, really, really. And I was fascinated of her foray in to jazz, to things that were, she didn't really fit in a particular category. So voice for me was always something that had, you know, there was a way of expressing things that you couldn't necessarily express any other way. But it took me a long time to kind of come around to really get deep into my composer identity. Even though I had been writing songs since I was about 11 or 12, I didn't think of myself as a composer. I thought, oh, okay, I write songs and I sing, you know. But there was some other idea of what a composer was. And even when I was thinking as in high school, you know, I was like, I want to go to school so I can learn how to write what I'm hearing in my head. How do I do that? Well, I didn't know, you know. And then life got a little complicated because I experienced a series of sexual assaults after high school. And so that, you know, that put a stop on me for a while. And I, instead of going to college, I went and worked at the Rape Crisis Center in Toronto and started to work with the effects of what that was for me, but also the effects of what it is to be female or marginalized in societies that use violence as a way to, you know, keep you down. So when I did end up in college, I was already an older student, you know, at 21 or 22 or whatever it was, you know, but, and it took me longer to do my bachelor, to finish that. It was hard to be writing and improvising and composing because the things that I wanted to, that I was drawn to try to express, I was afraid to present it for mostly male faculty. I mean, we had one female professor, so that was good. That was like, you know, that wasn't necessarily the case in other places, but it was good in that I had one, and I got to study with her, Diane Thome. She was amazing. She was the first woman who got her degree in composition from Princeton in electronic and computer music, in PhD. Hmm. So, you know, then that kind of fear of what is okay to put out there into the world meant that I ended up really choosing to just, okay, I'm going to perform. I'm going to focus on, I'm performing other people's music. I'm learning to be an opera singer. I'm doing Baroque, or I'm doing Lieder, or I'm doing new music, whatever, but it's stuff in front of me. And yet, you know, the impulse is still there. So after a while, I kind of had to come back to composition. And the first major piece that I came back to was a piece that a festival director in Italy somehow had, you know, heard an early work from me in a festival in Alaska. And she had the generosity to offer me a commission. And so I wrote a piece for Wint Trio and voice and narrator, and I used the Hildegard text of speak what you know or say what you see, you know, this kind of thing. And then it was, of course, all about dealing with violence and the body remembering trauma. And I don't even have the score anymore to that piece because it was just like, okay, I'm putting it out. I'm risking. And then couldn't really deal with.
No recording?
I have a recording, but I don't have the actual score anymore.
Yeah.
So still a long trajectory, you know. And the thing that really changed for me was working with Pauline Oliveros, because her work, both in kind of the focus on listening, the meditative nature of the retreats that she does, she did. She's probably still doing it, still listening mm-hmm. from the ether, you know. But and her acceptance of just, you know, go with what you need to go with, allowed me the confidence to start improvising. And that was the key to get back to the composing. So, yeah, I was improvising with machine sounds or, you know, city things, trucks that are going beep, 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 or whatever I was finding in a site-specific place. That was a long story.
Oh, it was a great story. Yeah. And thanks for sharing. And we'd like to listen to some music that you have brought.
I was thinking maybe it would be interesting to listen to chapel meditation, because it's an example of an improvised, what I call a spontaneous composition, because I'm thinking compositionally as I'm going, but it's not like I've started with a motive. I start with a sound, and in this particular one, I was in sorry, I'll back up a little bit. The recording that I have is a recording we made in Trondheim just a few years ago, but the original improvised piece was improvised in a church in Vermont, and it was an amazingly beautiful resonance in the church. And the piano, when I would pluck the strings, I could hear the harmonics really ring out in the church. So I basically started the improvisation with the plucked piano and then just followed. Where does my voice want to go with this? What is happening structurally? And that was a piece, and then I wrote it down afterwards and have performed it and recorded it again.
So, yeah, let's hear it. Was it Chapel Meditation
mm-hmm.
by Kristin Dordervall?
Thank you.
So that was chamber meditation.
Chapel meditation.
Chapel, sorry, yeah, chapel meditation. Okay. Now everybody will remember it because I said it wrong. Chapel meditation by Kristin Nordahl. And wow, it's so serene and beautiful.
It pure. Was, yeah, and it was a time, you know, it was right after 9/11. Or not right after, but it was in that season after. It was in the spring of 2002, I think, or it was late fall 2001. I don't remember. I was singing with a medieval group, Parthenia. I mean, sorry, no, Pomerium. Pomerium. I'm also making mistakes here. Pomerium. Parthenia is the other group, the chamber group that I've written for. But Pomerium was a medieval and Renaissance vocal ensemble, and we were there recording other work. And then I just used the time in the chapel to record my own. But there was something about that time of dealing with all the the excuses that were gonna build to a war that people didn't want, and there were many of us that were protesting against it. But you know, you feel these sort of enormous forces. And sometimes I just felt like, okay, just have to breathe and try and stay calm in the storm.
Yeah. That's actually what this piece helped me to do today. I was walking in a very busy street with huge trucks passing, and when I listened to this, I felt such peace in the middle of this noisy environment.
That's nice. Yeah. Thank you. I'm glad.
And then I entered a coffee shop and I had the most mindful cortado in my life.
Yeah, it's again, it's so pure and so beautiful. And Agata, you also said while we were listening that you felt that it kind of changed space.
Yes, because, definitely.
Yeah.
It's, I know this coffee shop quite well, and it has a specific vibe as well, which is also a little bit spacious and mindful. Also the design in there, I'm talking about a cafe in Oslo called Fulen. Mm-hmm. Design in there is quite minimalistic, Japanese-like, but when I entered it, it changed even more. I don't know, I just felt very protected by this music there.
Yeah, and we just recorded an episode with Alex Novitz, and we asked him about feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and if he uses or gets affected somehow by feelings when he sings. Yeah. And he had two answers, and one of them was that it would be... No, it's actually kind of one answer. But the point is that if he gets too affected by voices, it could make him lose control of the voice. So his approach to singing is, and this is not his word, but like it sounded like he's kind of surgical. I mean, he's controlling it, right? So I was wondering how is your approach to that? Because this one you said it's kind of meditative, and it's also in a way maybe even coming from a sense of grief, or certainly not without feeling, right?
That's true.
So how is your approach to this generally?
I always need to sing with feeling. If I'm, even if it's something that's just it's fun, it's still feeling, you know, or abstract, there has to be something there for me. And it's true, if you're extremely emotional, upset, it affects your voice. But that's something that's kind of interesting to me, like that you can hear both in people's speaking voices and in people's singing voices. Where are you? How are you? How are you doing? And I feel like I have to have a reason to sing.
So how does it affect it, like for instance if you're Do you try to like, do you have to feel it or can you make yourself feel it in order to sing in a certain way?
No, you can go into a certain thing. You go into a thought or concentration or whatever. Yeah, definitely. But there are other times when it comes automatically. Mm-hmm. So like in this past season of COVID, I had to do a type of a vocal meditation out in Birkelunden, and I used the bells of Pauluskirche as my accompaniment. Mm-hmm. And it was really a song sending out my mourning, especially in response to having understood that New York was digging mass graves on a place where people who were are forgotten or not claimed have been buried for many years out on an island near, and it's near City Island, which I know very well. I've had friends that have lived there, so I had this very visceral response to, oh my God, they're digging mass graves, and the people who are digging the mass graves are incarcerated people. It was just so viscerally painful. So I sang a kind of an elegy for these people who had nobody to mourn them.
Right.
And that was a necessity for me, just to put it out in the world. There was another track that I suggested, you know, that we could listen to, which is Gameplay. And that was a necessity of this kind of, what do you do with the real visceral anger, agitation stuff? And in those cases, it can come just from the voice. You know, you can put a real edge into your voice and people can hear it, right? Mm-hmm. Whether you're speaking or whether you're singing. But when you're playing with digital technology, you can even do more stuff. So you've got these tools that can help you really ramp up that edge. So
you could be doing like angry movements or something with your body, or
This particular piece was with knobs, mm-hmm. so I wasn't doing any particular body movements.
Okay, but control.
It was a little controller, little pitch bend. Yeah.
Okay, let's have a listen.
Oh, my God.
that was more music by Kristin Nordervall, a lot of electronics and and processing there, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Great. What were we going to talk about now again? I get my little daughter is calling me. So
you suggested to ask about my research into electronics.
Yes, your research. And also, I mean, like, it goes into renewing opera, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of the topics for mm-hmm. this Night of New Vocalities broadcast.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess you can hear that I am a trained opera singer. Maybe. I don't know.
I definitely can.
I did do a little bit of traditional opera repertoire, but I kind of consciousness raised myself out of a career quickly when I realized that the most interesting thing was to work with composers who were creating new things in kind of a collaborative structure, or to create my own works, either solo things or with other people. And then you get to choose what kind of stories you're looking at, whose voices you're amplifying literally, and what you're putting out in the world.
Why do you think it's important to renew opera?
First of all, opera, as it is done in most opera houses around the world, only looks at about a 75-year period. And it's the height of colonialism, and it's sexist, and it's racist, and it's museum material. Mm. And,
Okay.
And I think if you broaden the term to the original meaning, which was just work, right, opera, it's like opus, it's work. And it's work that includes the visual, the oral, theatrical, storytelling. Mm-hmm. If you want to think about storytelling, you can think about it in a lot of different ways. So, I mean, I have a very traditional opera training, but through working with Pauline Oliveros, through working with other improvisers, getting hired to tour with Philip Glass in Einstein on the Beach, that was a real change mm-hmm. in my awareness of what opera could be. I had also, experienced being in the chorus, being a professional chorus member in the San Francisco Symphony when John Adams did his first concert performance of Nixon in China.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing the kind of directions that opera could go mm-hmm. was very exciting to open up. And then the contrast with where it was at that time, which is when we're talking about the 90s, then I thought, okay, I have to just find other people to work with that are really exploring this.
Mm.
And it wasn't going to be the traditional opera companies.
Mm-hmm.
Now in the States, things are changing quite a bit. So there's a lot more new pieces that are, being created that are very, that are inspiring. And there's more types of composers and musicians doing them.
Do you think that extending the voice with the electronical devices was a natural move to design a new opera, or was it something extra?
It was a move. Well, first, when I was not particularly ever drawn to amplified voice,
mm-hmm.
Because I love the direct signal mm-hmm. of a voice coming from my body to going to other people's bodies through their ears. It's very direct and mm-hmm. and intimate and naked in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw somebody demonstrate Max MSP
mm-hmm.
in a conference on new opera in Montreal that was sponsored by Chant Libre, which is a company I later ended up writing an opera mm-hmm. for. And my response to that was, wow, this is not like your standard off-the-box commercial thing that limits what you can do to 30 seconds or whatever it was that the loopers limited it to. Mm-hmm. You could design a program where you could have very short delays, very long delays, go very quickly between. You can design your whatever filters you're working with. And so that was really the thing that you know, put me onto that. And learning Max MSP and then working with it and then incorporating these hemispherical speakers that I like to work with that I've talked about before that end up allowing you to perform not amplified, and the digital signals that you're working with can be coming from these hemispherical speakers in a way that's more like chamber music. Mm-hmm. That gave me kind of self-sufficiency, because then I could do the things on my own and I could bypass the gatekeepers, bypass the sound technician, bypass the, you know, the publishers. So that's what I've seen other female composers or marginalized composers that are working with electronics. It becomes a way that you can put out what you have to do much more empowered.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great.
Mm, yeah, it is great.
It's just so interesting.
Yeah.
But I wonder how you, because you have written more than one opera, I think.
Well, yes, although the ones before the Trials of Patricia Isasa were more kind of hybrid, sort of semi-theater, semi-opera, or even collaborations with other singer-composers.
You're also making one now, which we heard an excerpt from in another broadcast episode. And how do you make an opera? Like, I know it's a long process, but like, typically, like, how do you start and how do you go about that?
Yeah, it's a long process. I avoided it for a long time, and then I was making these pieces that were gradually becoming more and more operatic, and people were saying, that sounds operatic, maybe you have to write an opera. And so in the case of The Trials of Patricia Isasa, which was my first sort of full-length fully staged opera with chorus, six soloists and a chamber orchestra and electronics, I started that because I heard the person who it's based on, Patricia Isasa, I heard her on a news program talking about how it was to have won a court case in Argentina 33 years after she had been kidnapped. So she testified against, she was a teenager during the Argentine Dirty Wars, during the military dictatorship. And as a high school student, she was disappeared and taken away and, you know, tortured and kept for 2 years in prison. And when Argentina, there was some dealing with those crimes immediately after the end of the dictatorship, but not so much. And so there was a period of, like, people not dealing. And then with a different, when the Kirchner regime came in, they started looking back, and people who had been disappeared but had survived were starting to come with their stories and then making court cases. So she was one of those first people to do that. And such a strong personality to have survived this. And she had a sense of humor. It was like, wow, this this is just way too big for a normal person's life. So it's so big, it needs an opera. But I didn't actually start out thinking of it as an opera. I thought I just need to do a piece on her. And I started corresponding with her, and she said, okay, you know, and then it grew, and it became obvious I needed to have a real writer do the text, and I got an amazing playwright, Naomi Wallace. I loved her language. And so it grew from there. We did workshops here in Oslo. We did workshops in New York. I had an ensemble in New York that played some excerpts that started it off, and it eventually got the backing of this little company in Montreal in Canada that all they do is new work. So,
but how did you like translate? I mean, that one thing is the libretto, but how did you translate things into melody and harmony, or even electronic things? Like, because I know storytelling is very important to you.
Yeah,
and it's not always about even words.
No.
And I know that also in some opera, like Mozart was very good at this. He would be, I learned this from my sister who's an opera singer, he would be, like the lyrics would be something about what you're consciously thinking to yourself or you are saying, and the music would be saying, it could be saying the opposite. It's your subconscious things, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So there are always many elements of the, mm-hmm. of the storytelling. So I'm just curious how you approach this.
Well, it was a long process. So that particular opera took about 5 years. And some of it, well, it started with just conversations, me and Patricia, and we taped ourselves. She came to New York. She stayed with me for a few days, and we taped our conversations. And so her descriptions of what she had heard in the prison were very salient to me. Her voice shows up in the electronic score at a particular point when we're dealing with flashbacks from the court scene, her thinking about being in the prison. I took some media from that period, like there are radio interviews of that time that ended up in the electronic score. And it's really just kind of bit by bit, you know. I always go through the words, whatever words I'm getting from the author, the librettist that I'm working with. I have to kind of play with it, say it out loud, sing it, improvise, digest it, dream about it, think about them as I'm going, until I really feel like this is the melody that these words need. And there are times when, actually mostly I've experienced that there's more words than you need, and so a lot of them fall away. If they don't get the music that seems to fit them, then those words fall away.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you have to, among other things, dream about it during the process. Is it something important for you? Do you have intense dreams while you're in the process of composing an opera?
I have, yeah. Mm. Yeah. And as the music gets more and more developed, I start dreaming the music as well. Mm. So I suppose that the brain is working on finding the next solution to musical problems.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. I'm not sure if you brought anything from this opera today.
I didn't. But I do have a piece that was one of the pieces that people said, oh, that's operatic. You have to write an opera.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that will do.
Okay. So that would be... I wrote a suite of songs for the Parthenia Viola da Gamba Quartet in New York, and they wanted to use texts of Elizabeth I, the Queen. And I said, "Okay, show me what you've got." And so I pulled out the most politically paranoid poems that she had written while she was imprisoned in the Tower of London. And I set those. And this last piece, which is called Oh Fortune, is a couple poems sort of merged together of hers that are describing this fragility of enemies and being, you know, aware of your fate maybe going. And I recorded the viola da gambas, and so all of the electronics is made with source material from the viola da gambas, but processed in certain ways. And we when we perform it, we are using my hemispherical speakers.
Amazing. Are you ready there? Yeah, okay. Kristin Nordevall there. with beautiful music, and she was told it was operatic, and she wrote an opera. That's great. Yeah, and Agata, while we were listening, you also had some comments about the Viola da Gamba.
Yeah, I just remembered a discussion with my friend and the great researcher Merve Akça, who researches attention, auditory attention, let's say. And she noticed how the sound of a cello, which is, I think, a bit similar to the sound of Viola da Gamba, resembles a human voice, so that it's actually easy to confuse when you have a very short snippet of a human voice and a very short snippet of a cello, among other sounds. It's easy to confuse which one is a human voice and which one is a cello. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And I think the Viola da Gamba is even closer to the voice.
Yes, yeah. I thought so while I was listening.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So, and how is, maybe you can tell us a few words about your research as well, which is ongoing.
Mm. Yeah, I am researching the challenges of using live electronics in opera. And there is a couple of issues. One is that opera singers, you know, like to sing unamplified because that's what we train for. So how do you combine electronic voice with the unamplified operatic voice, or electronic signals in a way that balance? And since I'm interested also in agency and promoting the agency of singers, I'm looking at controllers that an opera singer might be able to use that wouldn't be like the normal kind of controller that you see often in new music, where a person is dependent on a computer screen, they're twiddling knobs, they're maybe doing faders and stuff, because that doesn't necessarily fit in all kinds of stories, you know. It's like you have to, okay, it's got to be a story about somebody dealing with a computer. So I've been looking at controllers that can be independent of the screen. You don't need a visual interface. And that means that I've been working with some wireless MIDI rings. I've been working with a music controller that was developed by Mari Kimura. And she's bi-coastal between New York and California. And various things that you could either have on your body, like a ring, or wear, or have an object as a prop. And
like a magic wand.
Oh, like a magic wand. Sure. Yeah that
or
could
like,
be.
Like a Nintendo controller.
Right.
As Alex mentioned.
Yeah depending on what kind of opera it is, right?
Right.
Yeah. Could be.
Yeah. So, and there, and the thing that has been really interesting in my work is that I'm also kind of, because I'm trying to gear the electronic sound to the acoustic sound of the singers and the instrumentalists, I'm also drawn to what kind of sounds can be acoustic but sound electronic. Mm. And so for the excerpts that you heard in last night's concert, which are excerpts from the new opera, The Sailmaker's Wife, I'm using long piano strings that are hung from the lighting rig, from the metal poles, and then resonate through a plywood rectangle and are weighted with a loom weight which is metal also. Mm-hmm. So when you bow on the loom weight hook, this is a technical description that maybe may not make sense. You get a high, kind of a high harmonic, but it also resonates the metal lighting rig. And all of that kind of, you know how when you hear the tram coming on the electric wires, mm-hmm. and it's both acoustic and it sounds electronic? Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like that.
Right.
So that the string itself has an electronic sound, but it is acoustic.
Hmm. Did we hear that in another episode with you, or was that another part of it?
That was another part of it.
Okay, so people have to just remember to listen to The Sailmaker's Wife whenever that's possible.
Yeah.
When will that be possible anyway? to hear like the whole work?
Aiming for a complete concert, semi-staged production or performance of it sometime in 2023, like spring or early summer.
So it's part of your research?
Yeah, it's part of my research. Yeah.
Okay. Do we need to... We still have a few more minutes and then we're going to listen to one more piece.
Okay.
Any final thoughts on anything or...
I don't know. I feel like it's a big subject and we could talk forever, and you do a wonderful job of inviting people in with all kinds of different music. So thank you very much.
Yeah, and thank you so much, Kristin Nordervall, and it was a pleasure to have you here in Solveig Space Music. And thank you again to special guest / co-host Agata Jelkowska.
Thank you very much.
It's been so great. And so the last piece that we will listen to today is a summons?
Yeah, the last piece is a summons. And that's an example of a compositional structure where I give myself a particular set in the max patch where I know, okay, I've got three different delay feedback lines and they're on this and they're in this and I'm going to do this. It's like a set of instructions, right? But it's also an emotional instruction. I want to summon, to call forth accountability. So I'm sort of embodying what is it that has been gone through and where do I want to take it and what do I want you to know?
Oh.
That's sort of,
It's a very fascinating title and subject. Okay, so Anders will spin the CD. And thank you once more, Kristin Nordervall and Agata Jelichowska, and of course Anders, and of course everybody who listened.
Thank you.
Thank you. I love you.